Hello, my name is Lauren Layfield, and this is Your Next Podcast, the podcast which curates a brilliant list of shows for you to try, adding a new one every single week. So there's a statistic that has been quoted a lot on the news, which blows my mind a little bit, and it's this. This year, 50% of the world's population will go to the polls in an election. Isn't that crazy? So how timely is it then that there's a brand new politics podcast from Sky? It's called Electoral Dysfunction, and it's hosted by Sky's political editor, Beth Rigby. And she's joined every Friday by Labour MP Jess Phillips, who I've interviewed, and it was one of the best interviewees I've ever had in my life. And also former leader of the Scottish Conservatives, Ruth Davidson. I know, there is not a man in sight on this podcast, and it's to do with politics. Brilliant, we love it. The trio are totally no-nonsense, very down to earth. I mean, it all sounds fantastic, but quite honestly, you had me at the name of the show alone.
I'm flying solo today in my little pod booth in London. Jess, where are you?
I am in Birmingham. This is literally where I am, is my bedroom, the dressing room part of my bedroom, because I'm very fancy.
Ruth, where are you? You at home?
I am in officially the best place in the United Kingdom to live. I'm in my house in North Berwick in East Lothian.
I'm Beth Rigby, and this is Electoral Dysfunction. What a week it's been. I was absolutely knackered by Monday because I spent quite a lot of the weekend phoning Tories around to discuss potential Tory plots. So we've got a lot to talk about. First up, Rishi Sunak. Has he gone from being embattled to beleaguered? Got to ask Ruth that in a minute. And what about the surprise resignation of Leo Varadkar? I was in makeup at Sky News getting ready to go and do PMQ's panel, and then suddenly a news editor runs in and goes, Leo Varadkar's about to do a statement and he's going to stand down. And it was an absolute boom bombshell. No one was expecting that. So we did a pivot to Ireland and Leo Varadkar. So we're going to talk about him and his legacy. And then, of course, Rwanda. So much to talk about. Will the flights take off before the election? And today, the highest number of migrants crossed the channel in a single day this year. You know, the Prime Minister talks a lot about boat crossings being down by a third, but on the back of the figures out at the moment, they look to be about 10% higher this year than they were at the same point in 2023. So that is a lot to get through. Now, we have some more of your messages. You can WhatsApp voice note us on 07934 200 444. And the email is electoraldysfunction@sky.uk. Also, we want your questions, which we are going to try and answer in a special Easter episode. So send us some questions in. You can ask these two wonderful ladies, Jess and Ruth, anything you want.
Literally anything.
So send them in. Now, let's start with Rishi Sunak. Is he having an electoral dysfunction? Listen to this clip. It's from AJ.
I can't work out what Rishi wants his legacy to be. No, he's going to be the one that makes a difference. He's not like anyone else. The only way I'm going to believe that is if he stands up and says, do you know what? My party's broken. We can't do this. We need to go away, rethink, and for God's sake, let someone else fix the country because they have broken it.
Well, that was AJ there. Now, Ruth, last week we were talking about Rishi Sunak and you said that he was embattled and that he was one step away from beleaguered. And when you're beleaguered, you're a swear word that I'm apparently not allowed to say, but you go ahead.
Fucked.
That's the one.
That is the word I said. Although, to be fair, it was you said he was embattled. And I said, you don't want to be embattled because that's only one away from beleaguered. And when you're beleaguered, you're fucked.
OK, well, is he embattled and is he beleaguered? Over to you, Ruth.
Yeah, I think he is embattled. I'm not entirely sure he's beleaguered yet. I think there was a flashpoint of danger when he was meeting with the 1922, as is almost always the case when you actually face people down that are agitating for you to go. They're a bit paper tigery. In terms of some of the decisions that he's making, I think he's recognising that he's a bit embattled. So yeah, so I don't think necessarily he's plotting a course that he would make if he didn't feel pressure. And when you're under pressure, sometimes you have trade-offs that you don't want to make, or you start making mistakes because it's harder to make decisions under pressure.
So do you think he's in a worse place now than he was even a week ago when we first talked about it?
I'm not sure he is. I think the flashpoint is going to be the elections in May. So he's, by that point, everyone's going to be knocking doors that's standing again over the Easter holidays. So people have been getting direct feedback from the doorsteps. We're probably going to see some pretty chastening results in England in the local authority elections in May. That'll be a big indicator of how the general election is going to go. It'll be the last kind of moment to really think about changing leader before the general election. I don't think it's going to happen. But then off the back of that, we may well see even more Tory MPs saying they're not going to contest the election when it comes. And I think he's safe for the next 2-3 weeks. I think there's going to be a hard reckoning at the start of May.
Hard reckoning. I had to make so many calls over the weekend and this week. God, this week feels like about 3 weeks in one, about where the party was at, because it was so febrile and you got to get around all the different wings and speak to sort of some of the sensibles, some of the agitators, some of the grandees, some of the ones you trust to give you kind of tell it how it was or is. It's a bit calmer, Ruth, but I do not think in any way, as you said, that he is safe and that there isn't a real risk that he could face a confidence vote after the locals.
Well, I think there's a point coming where I think in some polls now, there's only maybe 4 or 5% difference between the Tories and Reform. If there's a crossover poll, that will really shake the foundations. Even if it's just one, even if it's an outlier, people will get really jittery at that as well. And if it comes at around the same time that you see the locals coming in, people are coming back to Parliament after having been away for a couple of weeks and catching up with colleagues saying, oh, it's terrible even in the Shires. He's going to have a wobble, I would reckon, beginning of May.
I think he's beleaguered.
You've been sitting there just waiting to say that, haven't you? Just saying.
Don't talk over Ruth was the instruction that I was given. And however, I'm now going to break that instruction and say, I think he's totally beleaguered, but he's not alone. Because the way that it plays out in Parliament, Monday, you can tell when something's happening because literally the halls are lined with journalists, the central lobby and then the members' lobby. There's a couple of corridors that lead to it. And you can always tell there's something afoot because there's all these people like dotted around looking for people plotting. And so I was like, oh, what's going on? It's exciting. I saw Michelle Donnellan. She looked awful. I tried to get the gossip on that. I think she's just got a cold. So basically it felt febrile on Monday. And every Monday for the last 6 weeks, pretty much basically since we came back after Christmas, every Monday I've thought the election was going to be in May, because every Monday there is some sort of terrible pitch point. I don't know what Rishi Sunak does to his MPs over the weekend or why he thinks sending them home is a good idea, because the weekend starts to make them febrile for some reason. And then on Monday, it feels like he's going to be toppled by some coup or whatever. And then by Tuesday, it's sort of like everybody's just slagging off the cooers. And then by Wednesday, it's like he's all right again. And that happens every single week, week in, week out at the moment. And it's so tedious. They cannot get a coup off the ground because they are not a united force themselves. It feels like the whole thing is beleaguered, but it felt more beleaguered this week than ever before. You had people having argy-bargy in the tea rooms.
Oh, who was argy-bargying?
Well, I don't like to mention names, but people were argy-bargying with the immigration minister in the tea room. They were basically saying, why are you paying £3,000 for people to get on the Rwanda thing? Like, why don't you just clear the backlog? Genuinely, Tory MPs, like, being annoyed at the new flavour of the Rwanda story. They're beleaguered. A plague on all of them.
Ruth, when you speak to some, you know obviously lots of MPs as well, when you speak to some of your mates in the Conservative Party still knocking about Westminster and, you know, AIDS, etc., what are you picking up?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think up until probably about autumn last year, there was still a question mark about whether this was going to be a 97 or a 92 election. And I think from about October onwards, everybody is expecting that it's going to be tough and that they're going to lose a lot of colleagues. And it's not going to be, you know, out of office for one term. It's going to be a pretty big kind of hit.
But when we talk about this potentially being a change election, and you've talked about that in some of the past pods, are you saying that you think that the Tories could be out of power for not one term but two?
If history's anything to go by, there is a gap by which it's hard to bounce back within a single term. And also, when parties go out of power, there's usually a bit of a reckoning for that. And then they decide that they want power and they come back and start making more sensible decisions and get into challenger mode.
I want to go back to plotting because, Jess, you were talking about it all being quite tedious. And I have to say, journalistically, it is a combination of a bit tedious and exhausting trying to get across it because you want to have your Saturday and suddenly you're trying to have to phone, you know, I'm having to phone Penny Mordaunt to find out if Penny Mordaunt really is about to launch a coup. Listener, she was not. She was actually out campaigning in her constituency of Portsmouth. But what I wanted to ask Ruth was, let's try and unpick what's going on a bit to explain to our listeners, like, how do these plots come about? Why do they kind of end up on the front of the Daily Mail on a Saturday and then by Wednesday, apparently it was never going to happen? Like, some insider insight to plotting would be good. I can give you my perspective as well, what it's like trying to cover one.
In terms of being inside a coup plot, I don't know, I've never really done one. The only time I've really kind of properly agitated, I guess, for a change of leader is I did write a letter to the leader of the chairman of the 1922 committee after the European elections for Theresa May to be replaced because I thought, you know, there was no place for her to go. And I'm not an MP, so, you know, I'm not part of the parliamentary party, but I wanted to record as the leader in Scotland what the view of the parliamentary party and the Scottish party and Scottish Parliament and my membership around the country was. But I mean, I would always kind of do it face to face. I think I just must be crap at this sort of thing because I'm just not a plotter. I'm not really one for huddles and if we do this and then we can destabilise that. Like, just like, either you think you'd be better, go after the job, or don't. Shut up, do it.
You were the victim of a plot though, weren't you?
Yeah, I had a couple of times they tried to shake the tree with me, so...
The bastards.
I had kind of interesting start because I was only elected in May and I was leader by November. So we'd had quite a bad election in Scotland when I got elected and I was the only new MSP, the only new member of parliament in Scotland. All of the other MSPs, obviously they were all sort of older and more experienced than me, but none of them really wanted me to be the party leader. There was a lot of anonymous briefing and it went on probably off and on for the first sort of 18 months, 2 years. And, you know, I had a very steep learning curve. I wasn't the best leader when I started. I hope that I got better as I went on. But I had a bit of a showdown with the outrider of one of them. So I had a kind of sit-down meeting in the Millennium Hotel. There was nobody else. It was just the two of us. And I properly dug in and I said, look, if they want to come for me, they can fucking come for me. Like, don't be doing any of this. If they want to take the job, that's grand. But they couldn't win in an election of the membership. If they think they can do it by anonymous briefings, that's not going to be enough. I'm not going to walk. They will have to take this job from me because I'm, you know, what the membership voted for. This is what we've chosen to do. We've got a referendum coming where keeping Scotland within the United Kingdom is far more important than what happens to the Scottish Conservative Party. We must make sure that we get this part right. And, you know, as soon as you face people down, they melt away. People want led. People within political parties, they want led. And as soon as you become the leader, even if it was a really close contest, you have another element to it and it becomes harder. It becomes harder to depose a leader than somebody than defeating somebody in a leadership election.
So on Penny Mordaunt, the curious thing about all of this is that she obviously ran against Liz Truss. She then tried it against Rishi Sunak. She is actively getting around all of the associations around the country. I'm sure she definitely has leadership ambitions. You all might remember her from carrying that massive sword. You remember that at the coronation, the giant sword, which she carried for about 50 plus minutes, arms of steel.
There's a certain selection of our listeners that will also remember her from Splash, where she wore a swimsuit.
Splash? Yeah. I can't think of anything I would rather less do than one, wear a swimsuit on national television, never, and two, jump, dive off, yeah, the top board.
Penny Mordaunt, the rumours that went around this week, the overarching view in Parliament from Tory MPs that I spoke to is that the Penny Mordaunt rumours came from Rishi. They came from Number 10 as much as anywhere else. So they're basically, they're trying to smoke out the opposition, which is not uncommon. So I think that you know, that's the view, is that the plotting was, lots of it was coming from Number 10 itself. But Penny Mordaunt is absolutely plotting, I don't think to topple Rishi Sunak, but to be the leader after Rishi Sunak, and rather than be the Prime Minister, but be the leader of the Tory party. And it's very, very, very obvious to anybody watching that that is the case. Penny Mordaunt is absolutely on manoeuvres.
So on the plotting thing, that's really interesting, Jess, that that's going around, because you know what you were saying, Ruth, about kind of politicians do it all in the shadows. I actually had contact with Penny on Saturday, and she actually did say something. She didn't want to make a big deal. She didn't want to, as she said, fan the flames of it. But she told me the public are rather tired of these stories. And she made it clear that, from her perspective, the stuff in the papers were nonsense. When I put that out online, I got a bit of rebuttal from other people in different bits of the party that made me think maybe they were the people that were trying to push this line. The line effectively was that the right of the party, so some of the groupings on the right of the party, were prepared to have Penny Mordaunt as a potential successor to Rishi Sunak, like a unity candidate, because she's not of that wing of the party, in order to get Rishi out of the job and Penny in. Now, there's a few things going on there. Number one, whether Penny would ever do that in terms of those people backing her. Because the other criteria was that Penny would have to give the right vetoes on social issues, because part of the problem she's had with different wings of the party is they think that she's too socially progressive when it comes to issues around trans rights, etc., right? But the whole thing was kind of a little bit pie in the sky that Penny gets brought in order to kind of be a unity candidate in a party where they're fighting like ferrets in a sack, basically, for ascendancy. So, you know, Jess, you're absolutely spot on. Penny, of course, is on manoeuvres. Grant Shapps, he reckons himself for the job. Ruth, Grant's having a little go. You got Kemi Badenoch. There's lots of talk around her still. Priti Patel, my early little candidate that I mentioned.
Oh, yeah, Priti.
Flying under the radar. Priti also might get the backing of Boris Johnson, of course.
Yeah, I reckon she would. I agree with you. I think we're on the money from the very get-go.
Priti Patel is flying under the radar, but making up ground, maybe overtaking people in this race, but we just don't know it yet.
I mean, I think that, you know, you've read out a whole list of people as potential candidates to replace Rishi Sunak and be the Prime Minister. And I think the more people look at what the alternatives might be, the more they're going to bang their desk to Rishi Sunak every time there's a 1922 committee. Because, you know, whatever you think of his ability to do the politics of politics, as a serious person who is smart enough for the job, who is qualified enough for the job, you know, he is, you know, who works hard, who is, you know, has a solidity about him. He is all of these things. It might just be that the Tory party just has to go into the next election, you know, with their chin out, with him as Prime Minister. And I think that is what's going to happen.
You talked about May the 2nd being a wobble. How big a moment is it going to be? Ruth, do you think he will face a confidence vote after May the 2nd? And for listeners, a confidence vote is when 50 or so Conservative MPs put a letter in to the chair, to the convener of the backbenchers, to say that they don't have confidence in a Prime Minister, and then it triggers a vote.
It depends. It depends whether May the 2nd is a bloodbath or whether it goes into the realms of annihilation. Like, being a bad night is already priced in. It's how bad a night it's going to be. And if it's much worse than people think it is, then I do think there is a high chance that there might be, in almost a kind of last roll of the dice sense. But then we come back to, who are the potential runners and riders? Are they better than the current Prime Minister? Are they able to put communicate a better narrative to the public? And are they more popular? And, you know, you're looking around the current sort of crop of people that are being mentioned, and there's not very many that I can see that fulfil that.
I was talking to a Conservative Party source the other night, and they said that Conservative campaign headquarters, they're basically the people that run the election, now want to be ready for an election in June in case the Prime Minister does face a confidence vote, in which point he can call an election, right? That's only one source, just to put it into context. And I put that to someone who is, you know, agitating, and they said that if the PM tried to go to the country to forestall a leadership challenge, he would be removed before he got to the palace.
Jesus.
I know, the bat phone is hot today.
That, again, that sounds classic paper tiger tough talk. How do you stop a prime minister from going to the palace when, like, the Sky News copter is in the air following him along? Like, I don't think so. You talk to people that are doing the, like, coup chat more than I will. They wouldn't come to me, but they would go to you and they would drop a bit in here. So who is it? Is it the outriders? Is it sort of MPs talking for their pals that they want to get into it, that think that they're getting ahead and doing it first? Is it the people themselves that have their eye on the job? Come on, tell us.
I think that part of the reason that this is all quite febrile and people don't really know what's going on is that it's all in the shadows, right? So all of the principals are like hands clean, and they've got proxies, and there's outriders, and there's gossip, and it builds up, and then someone will say something. And that's what, when I said that I had to make a lot of phone calls, I had to make a lot of phone calls because it's very disorganized. And when it's very disorganized, you have to go across lots and lots of different sources in order to try and piece together a picture of things that are unclear, which is why it is quite hard and it takes a lot of time. And that's why I get grumpy. Like, genuinely, this is tough to cover. Going back to what you said about paper tigers, Ruth, I kind of agree with you in the sense that everyone was a bit puffed up at the weekend, and there was this briefings going out about Mordaunt, and then a lot of pushback from Mordaunt's allies, right? And then it dissipates. But what hasn't dissipated, I don't think, is the nub of it, which is what you've talked about, which is the polling is terrible. Reform are now within 4 points according to one poll. You've got record migrant crossings today. So the fundamentals are all of the ingredients that make some in the party think we are going to face annihilation. If we change leader, at least we can manage the loss a bit. When it comes to a confidence vote, I think what helps the Prime Minister at the moment is it is not very organised. There is no one actively, I would say, if people are preparing campaigns, but is anyone actually ready to move? You know, that's a big open question.
Can I throw a curveball in about May the 2nd? You know that they can put the elections off.
What, the local elections?
Yep, they can move it to June. They do it. They used to do it for the European elections. I wouldn't put it past them.
I don't think they would.
I don't see it. She's flown a kite. We'll see how it lands.
That was a curveball, Jess. But I didn't see that one coming. Cover.
On this thing about the confidence vote, I do think that what you said, Ruth, is what I cannot work out is whether it comes about by accident rather than design, i.e. when the Boris team were trying to get rid of May, and it took many, many attempts, they were bloody organised, right? They were really organised. There is not that sort of level of organisation, and there's not one candidate that the party can coalesce around. But if people get really, really anxious, do you tip into the number of letters just because enough people are freaking out that you get to a confidence vote, which he'd probably win, right?
Yeah, but even when you win it, you don't win it.
You lose it.
Yeah. Everybody loses it. Doesn't matter what the outcome is.
Yeah, I think Jess is right. And we've seen it before. We've seen it with John Major. We've seen it with Theresa May. We've seen it down the years. A confidence vote is a sign that something is very wrong and you're on borrowed time. So even if you win and face down a confidence vote, you are damaged. I think your point is valid. There isn't an obvious successor here, which means there isn't the ruthlessness that you have of people desperate to get their man in or woman in the way that you had with Boris and the organisation that went into that. And you could see what they could see what they thought the prize was. So that gives you direction and it gives you focus. Here it's very disparate. There's, like, as you say, 5-6 different people that think they would have a chance and their pals think that their mate might have a chance. That doesn't bring the ruthlessness that you need to bring down a prime minister. However, it is chaotic enough that you could absolutely see a case where enough letters go in from enough people thinking that they're going to shake the tree a bit or put pressure on the prime minister that it tips over almost by mistake. And suddenly the party finds itself without a leader going, crap, right, who are we going to do now? With an election looming.
You know, like those flow charts where you go, this happens and then these are the options. Like, the Prime Minister's trying to sort of steer this kind of course towards an autumn election. And then there's like all these like fireballs coming in.
We talk about how the opposition to the prime minister or the people that fancy their chances to be the next leader aren't that organised. Where are the people that are bolstering the prime minister? Where are his allies right now? Every time there's some good news or there's something good on the grid, it gets washed away by other stories because people aren't out doing the hard yards of doing the studio tours. You know, we just had inflation down to one of its lowest levels for like 3 years or something. It's down below where we thought it was going to be. It's absolutely hitting the heights of one of the key things the Prime Minister said he was going to do before the next election. You know, where was the Chancellor going out there as the senior member of the Treasury team, absolutely doing the hard yards of every single studio and doing the communication part?
The reason is because they haven't got the staff. Genuinely, because like rats on a sinking ship, they just don't have the infrastructure. Doesn't matter how much money you've got, that if you cannot get good people who are experienced and know exactly what you just said has to happen, like, you know, like air war on your good news, like it's because they are beleaguered, I'm afraid. I feel like now we're at the Oxford Union and I'm arguing for beleaguered and you're arguing against.
Right, Leo Varadkar. Now, what do we think about this? He dropped the bombshell. He's 45 years old. He's been the leader of Fine Gael for 7 years. He's been the Taoiseach, that's the Irish Prime Minister, for two different like stints. And he just came out and announced that he was stepping down from the job and from the leader of the parties. No one saw it coming. I mean, it was... You know, normally you get a bit of rumour with this. I mean, he's had a bit of a torrid time, but it was a pretty big bombshell that dropped. Perhaps he saw the writing on the wall in terms of the next election in Ireland, which has to be held by March 2025 at the latest. But do we think he's come out on top this week because he's gone on his own terms at a time of his choosing? What do you think, Jess?
I think that you could definitely make that argument, and you could make... There's a number of sort of progressive, well-loved leaders recently who appear to come out absolutely on top. So Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand at a similar time to... Hold on to your hat here, Ruth. Nicola Sturgeon. And now Leo Varadkar seeming to sort of bow out at a high point, which is absolutely, you win at politics if you manage to do this, if you manage to go out respected and not just wholly slagged off. We look at these people, especially because, you know, quite a lot of populism has spread across the world. We look to people like Leo Varadkar and even Macron, Jacinda Ardern, and we think, oh, wouldn't that be nice if we had a bit of that sort of sensible centrism? And actually, if you speak to people who live in those countries, the sort of view from abroad is quite different to the people who actually live there. My mates who live in Ireland are basically all they ever talk to me about is both health and housing crises. Like they literally can't get houses. So I imagine he was probably about to be shot out of the cannon anyway. You know, it does seem like he's very on top, and actually it's the right thing for him, and he'll go out mainly being remembered for the legacy of like the abortion and the gay marriage and all of those good things.
When I think about Varadkar, I think about Brexit and the way in which he worked that with the European Union and caused Johnson some problems, and the way in which that seemed to kind of get him more of an audience in the US, although, of course, you know, the sort of Irish connection, particularly with Biden in the White House, has helped. That's my perspective of Varadkar. But, of course, he had these two referendums in Ireland, which he lost both of them.
Yeah, yeah.
One was about changing the language around women and women in the home in the constitution. And the second was about sort of expanding the definition of marriage.
Can I tell you my favourite thing that I want to remember Leo Varadkar for? Which, apart from gay marriage, but I think he should be remembered for the most craven note that a premier has ever sent to anybody in my life. And he sent it to Kylie Minogue. And it said, "Dear Kylie, just wanted to drop you a short note in advance of the concert in Dublin. I'm really looking forward to it. I'm a huge fan. I understand you're staying at the..." Is it Merion? He is a doctor, so he's got doctor's handwriting. "I'm staying in the Merion Hotel, which is just across the street from my office in government buildings. If you like, I'd love to welcome you to Ireland personally." Leo V. Didn't even find his full name. Leo V.
Yeah, but in the global status, right, Kylie does sit above Leo Varadkar. It's only right that...
if you were going to send that sort of note to someone that you really wanted to meet, who would be the bar for you, Jess?
Keanu Reeves, who I did actually once meet in Parliament.
I did too!
And I behaved, I didn't behave appallingly, I behaved like a blancmange. He's the only person I have ever met, and I've met, you know, like absolute A-list Hollywood stars. He's the only person I ever met, and I just literally stood there, and it was like, I love Keanu Reeves. I have seen the film Point Break 1 million times.
When I was a student, I worked in the Odeon Cinema in Edinburgh, which always held the opening and closing galas of the Edinburgh International Film Festival. And the staff at the closing gala got invited to the after party, which was at Dynamic Earth. And I'm a teenager here at like 19 or 20 or whatever, got very drunk, posh dress on, decide the bold Ruth's going to go up to John Cusack and tell him, as in like actual John Cusack, because he had Pushing Tin. He had
Pushing Tin, know it. Love John Cusack and all of his work.
There. I went up and said, you know, Mr. Cusack, you know, huge fan, blah, blah, blah. Would you like to dance? He was like, no, fuck. Like, he was very polite, said no. I was like, well, can you give me a kiss then?
Was this before you were a lesbian?
Yeah, it was before I was a lesbian. And he left the party shortly afterwards, and it's inexplicable as to why.
Did you get a kiss? Did you get a kiss?
Did I, heckers? Like, no, I didn't get a kiss. I was very drunk. But can you imagine asking actual John, actual Cusack, for a dance at a do at 19 years old? Like, what an idiot. What an absolute idiot.
I wish I'd asked Keanu Reeves for a kiss. I think he's so polite, he might have given me one.
Yeah, I think he would have.
We have slightly digressed, so I've got to get us back on track here. Now, hang on, just before we do, Ruth, just on Varadkar, what I was talking about was that he'd lost these couple of referendums that actually the country probably were broadly supportive of the policies, but the politics around how they went about the referendums was apparently really bad and they lost them. That was really damaging for his authority. I mean, do you think he goes out on a high or a low? No?
I don't think that's why he went. I mean, he became Taoiseach when he was 38, so pretty young. And he had, you know, with Brexit and with COVID and with all the other stuff that he was facing, he'd had quite a tough run. He'd also gone from being sort of undisputed Taoiseach and being the largest party by a long way within the government to having to form a coalition with both Fianna Fáil and the Greens. And, you know, was Taoiseach for a bit while the leader of the other main coalition partner was Taoiseach. And then I think he was canny in the politics and gave himself the best chance of letting the other guy have the first half of this parliament and he'd have the second half. So for his party going into the election, you've got all the trappings of kind of office and you can use that to your advantage. So I think he'd been canny there. But I think it probably is quite attritional. Like big jobs, they take it out of you. You do kind of feel like how much new ground by the end of it are you charting and are you doing the job better or worse than you started? And for me, when I stood down after 8 years, I didn't think I was doing the job as well at the end as like, I think I was dropping off. I was getting worse at it. And there is a point of professional pride where you don't want to continue doing something less well.
Let's pause here. Coming up, your messages and questions, including one for you, Jess. Why don't politicians answer the question? Welcome back. Let's talk about Rwanda. Now, the bill, which is about deporting failed asylum seekers to Rwanda, has been sent back to the Commons after peers rejected it, a defeat for the government. Now, Jess, I think to any listener out there, when we talk about a bill being ping-ponged and going back from the Commons to the Lords, can you explain what the hell is going on?
So the Lords have put in loads of changes to the legislation that frankly would liberalise it. So it's things like no children, no pregnant women would be able to be sent. It's other things about how what has to be put in place before Rwanda happens, like safeguards about monitoring human rights and that sort of thing. And then when they put those changes into the bill, it comes back to us and we vote on whether we want to keep those changes in. I voted for every one of the changes that the Lords asked for, and then it gets sent back to them. Now, ping pong is they will keep sending it back to us, and eventually somebody gives in. It's a bit like a sort of stalemate. Now, the Lords tend to not ping pong, not send it back to us after it's been sent back to them very many times, usually. And there's a couple of categories where they don't do it. They don't do it if it was in a manifesto. If it's in a manifesto, because we were elected by the people and the Lords weren't, they have this sort of recognition where they go, look, this was in the manifesto. They won the election on the basis of this. We shouldn't be touching this. The other things about finances they don't do as well. They don't mess around with the Treasury. And normally, after one ping pong, we have it, we send it to them, they send it back, we send it back, and then it comes back to us, and that's the end. Usually, that's the limit. I don't think that will be the case on Rwanda. Sorry, this is the first ping of the third piece of legislation that we've had on this that has failed.
So, Ruth, now you're a Conservative peer.
I am.
Government were trying to get a lot of the Conservative peers to go to the Lords on Wednesday night in order to try and get this bill through. They try and whip you. I know it's not as easy to whip the Lords, but they try and whip the Lords. It's more complicated, isn't it? Because, and again, for listeners, there's also crossbench peers in. So whilst the House of Commons is really like party political, the Lords is a bit different. There's what are called crossbench peers that are not aligned to either party. There are Conservative peers, Labour peers, Lib Dem peers, et cetera, et cetera. Did you go and vote? And did you get whipped? And did you just not want to? Like, how did it work from your perspective?
Yeah, so I told my whip, I think I'm on my third whip in the last 6 months or something like that, that they did not want me in the House because I would vote against absolutely every government position on this because I fundamentally disagree with the policy and I don't want to ease its passage in any way because I don't want it to become law. So at which point, when you tell them stuff like that in that way, they kind of leave you alone a little bit.
Because I was making some calls on this week, and if the government really wants to get this bill through before Parliament breaks up, it breaks up next Tuesday for Easter, they can do things like force the Lords just to keep sitting all night. They like railroaded it through by insisting that it has to keep going back to the Lords and being voted on to try and force it through. They've called it emergency legislation. It's been going through for about 4 months now. So it's going to come back after Easter. What is going on? What can they force it through, Ruth?
Well, it's clear that they don't want to now. There's been a trade-off here between keeping the MPs sweet and the pressure that was put on a lot of peers to get in. Even though they didn't overturn any of the Labour amendments that were put on, there was a big Tory turnout. You know, people came and stayed, and they'd had a lot of pressure put on them. I mean, I fundamentally don't understand why this is the hill that Rishi Sunak is trying to die on. Like, because the dogs in the street out there know that this won't make even, you know, a percentage difference to the amount of migration that comes to this country or not. Like, if you want to do something on immigration, and I am out of step, you know, we'll hold my hand up, I'm out of step with my party and with many people in the country about how we should talk about immigration and where the numbers should be and how we should be making sure that we have much more legal routes, that we are attracting the people that we want to come to this country, that we have a much fairer way of doing the assessment, and that we have a much quicker way of returning people who aren't supposed to be here that we say no to, rather than something like this, which is gimmicky. So, I just don't understand either the politics of it or the symbolism of it.
What's interesting to me as a hack about this, Ruth, is the fact you are so strongly against the policy and the fact that so many people in your party are so pro it.
I'm not sure that many of them are sold on this policy. They're sold on looking tough on immigration because they have pressures within their own constituencies. I mean, I think stopping the boats was the wrong tagline because it's impossible to happen and you'll be shown to have failed. Reducing illegal immigration, absolutely. You can have that as an aspiration and the Tories want to do that and that's fine.
They seem to think people really, really, really want it. And I've never met a person ever who really, really wants it.
So you both hate the policy. You both think it's a gimmick, which is the line that Keir Starmer has been now trotting out, probably because there is an expectation, I think a growing expectation, that maybe a flight or two or a few will go, right? But Ruth, isn't the thing for your party that it's a wedge issue between Reform and the Conservatives? Because when I went down to the Lee Anderson big moment a couple of weeks ago, Richard Tice from Reform was banging on about immigration, furious that the Conservatives had let voters down on the pledges they'd made in the manifesto about driving down numbers of immigration. There's a poll out today, only one poll. I have to say that because, you know, you've got to look at a poll of polls really to get a real sense of what's going on. But this poll will nevertheless really, really make many Conservatives nervous because, you know, the Conservatives have dropped below 20%. They're on 19%. Reformer on 15%. So when you sort of talk about not getting it, you surely get that for some of your colleagues, they think that being tough on immigration is about a bit about manifesto pledges, but also about trying to see off the threat of reform.
So let's look at how effective it is. And, you know, the tougher and tougher and tougher the Tory party has talked on immigration, the less and less effective, actually, the immigration service has been pretty much. It hasn't been working. And in terms of the current threat that they see from reform, the people that are crossing to reform are clearly not believing that the government is doing enough, no matter how much they talk. So it's not about getting one plane in the sky. I believe it's about efficacy. If we had shown as a government that there was a control here, there was an agency here, that this was not something that we were all constantly reacting to, but it was something that we were laying out and that it was working and that you know, that it was a process-driven system that clearly worked, I think we would be in a much better place.
The point is when you say, I don't know why he made it the hill to die on, he has. And I think that moment that they get a plane up in the sky, whatever you both think about it, politically, he'll be able to chalk that up as a win. Anyway, let's ask some questions now. We have a voice note from Ruth.
How refreshing to hear politicians talk about other politicians who don't answer questions. The impact on me and a great deal of my friends is that when they don't answer the questions repeatedly, what it does is it makes us not trust anything they say because they just simply will not be honest and open.
Oh, Ruth, thanks for that.
Do you know, I bet she makes cracking scones, that lady.
You have actually got a lovely voice, Ruth. Why don't politicians answer the questions? Jess, take it away.
They don't answer the questions because they were sent there to land a line that they have been told that they have to get across. And sometimes that's noble, Ruth. Sometimes you're there to talk about a specific policy that would be a good thing. And actually some terrible thing has befallen somebody else or some of the news story has come up and it's really quite irritating because you were there to talk about the thing you might have worked on for years. So you go, oh, and they try and get the line across. So that's the generous answer. The truth is as well is that before a politician goes on like Yakunsberg or sits in front of Badass Bear, they are literally drilled by like there's like four people and they're going and they practice the answers. The truth is that they're worried that they'll get held accountable for some of the things they say. You can accidentally say something and for it to be misrepresented, and then it's your whole week's work gone. And so you're trying to guard against that. What I wish politicians would understand, though, is that it's so unpopular. It's really deeply unpopular. So you should just answer the question. And sometimes, you know what, if you don't know the answer, just say, I don't know the answer. I don't know. And I know maybe I should know that. But the trouble is if you were that honest, the headlines for the rest of the week would be minister doesn't know what they're talking about. So we're in a sort of catch-22 about why politicians don't answer the questions.
Mm. Ruth, what do you think?
I think Jess is absolutely right in terms of kind of what's at stake. And there are some questions that, you know, the way it's framed, what the journalist is trying to get out of it. You get kind of canny at dealing with journalists that are trying to do the kind of gotcha interviews. But a lot of journalists aren't. They're actually asking you a question that they feel it is their job. As somebody that was a journalist for 10 years before I was a politician, I've always kind of appreciated the fact that I always felt I was asking on behalf of either my listener or the reader. And it's the answer to the questions that they want to know. Like I say, I've been really lucky because as the Scottish Party leader, I had my own mandate. You know, I've never in my entire political life really been subject to either preferment or promotion or anything like that. So nobody's ever been able to dangle a carrot for me being well behaved or really sanction me for being badly behaved. So I've got to be allowed to answer it in the way that I want it. And I fundamentally believe that even if you say something that you know the person that you're speaking to is going to disagree with, if you can explain why or explain that you really believe it, they will respect you more even if they disagree with you.
Just to pick up on that, Ruth, as well, like as someone that is asking the questions, I've done a few interviews this week and I've had a couple of politicians, I won't say who they are, but they were just, whatever question I asked them, it was like the Rolodex in their brain went, inflation answer, Labour spending plans answer, and they gave me a completely anodyne answer that was not answering a question that was aligned to take. Because what happens is politicians get given a briefing from central office from leader's office about lines to take in interviews. Now, more sophisticated politicians will take the lines to take and they'll make them their own lines. So it makes it sound like they're actually answering. When you probably get really annoyed is that they are literally trotting out lines to take. And then that also can create quite a bad interview, I think, because then the journalist gets annoyed as well. And the bigger issue about it is, and I agree with Ruth on this, is just that you then just do a disservice to the listener, because it's not the journalist you're not answering, it's the actual viewer or the listener. So, and I also think that saying I don't know is actually a reasonable answer. But I also think that there is a difference between, like, what's nice about doing this podcast is that we can actually chat. I'm not trying to force you into giving me an answer in a tight spot, or it's not on camera we actually are on camera, I can see all of you, but it's not a performative television thing. I think part of the reason that maybe you like listening to this podcast is that because podcasts give politicians and journalists a bit more space to chat rather than have a sort of adversarial, you know, knockabout, right? Now, Ruth and Jess, we are winding up. Jess, what are you doing this weekend?
I'm going to get drunk. That's the answer. For a variety of reasons. It's my friend Amy's birthday. Not a big birthday, but there's nobody who organises a soiree like my mate Amy. But also, my sister-in-law is Persian or Iranian, and it's Nowruz, which is New Year. We will be celebrating with her.
That sounds like a nice weekend. Ruth, what are you doing?
Matthew, I'm going to turn into a 1950s housewife this weekend. So I am making a tray bake tonight for taking to a social round the tennis club in my village. Oh, yes. Yes, I am. And then on Saturday, I am going to take a dress to get altered for a wedding.
Oh, Stranger Things was really good, by the way.
Oh, was it good?
Yeah, it was excellent. And now, I enjoyed it so much, I'm now watching the box set.
Have you never watched Stranger Things before?
Watched it years ago, okay. And now I'm re-watching it. But now I'm obsessed, so it's become a bit disruptive for me this week. But anyway, the other thing I did last weekend is I watched Dune number one, because I am going to now watch Dune number two this weekend. And I actually really like Dune number one, so I'm up for it now. That's it for today. Thank you for listening. We're all going into quite fun weekends, I think, after quite a torrid week in politics again. But we are back next week, but it's on Thursday next week, because we've got Good Friday the day after. I don't think we're doing it on Good Friday. So download it on Thursday. Thank you for listening. And remember, you can WhatsApp voice note us on 07934 200444, or send an email to electoraldysfunction@sky.uk. Don't forget, you can send us any question you want. And I'm really looking forward to finding out what you lot are going to ask Jess and Ruth. I've got some totally random questions to ask them that I am storing up. So thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And we'll be with you again next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
I mean, it's great. Talk about refreshing. I have immediately added this to be downloaded every single week, and I strongly recommend that you do the same. It's produced by Sky. Electoral Dysfunction is out weekly and available on Spotify, Amazon, Apple, or wherever you're listening to this. Once you've tapped follow for Electoral Dysfunction, don't forget to do the same for this show too, so you can find your next podcast. All my recommendations from the whole series will also be on Podcast Rex at www.podcastrex.com. podcastrex.com. That is www.podcastrex.com.